The region conquers and the Frenchmen fly! Now help, ye charming spells and periaps, and ye choice spirits that admonish me and give me signs of future accidents. You speedy helpers that are substitutes under the lordly monarch of the north, appear and aid me in this enterprise. This speedy and quick appearance argues proof of your accustomed diligence to me. Now, ye familiar spirits that are called out of the powerful regions under earth, help me this once that France may get the field. Oh, hold me not with silence over long. Where I was wont to feed you with my blood, I'll lop a member off and give it you in earnest to further benefit, so you do condescend to help me now. No hope to have redress. My body shall pay recompense if you will grant my suit. Cannot my body nor blood sacrifice entreat you to your wanted furtherance? Then take my soul, my body, soul, and all, before that England give the French the foil. See, they forsake me. Now the time has come that France must veil her lofty plumed crest and let her head fall into England's lap. My ancient incantations are too weak and hell too strong for me to buckle with. Now, France, thy glory droopeth to the dust.
The theater, the theater.
Sing out, Louis!
Theater, theater. To be or not to be.
Hey, friends.
Hello, friends. And new
End
friends.
End of the season blues, or are you feeling good?
Oh, I'm feeling great. It's almost Thanksgiving. I'm fucking stoked right now.
Shit. Yeah, you gonna eat some turkey?
I've gotta make a batch of sugar cookie dough tonight to chill overnight.
Oh my god.
Yum.
I've made the cornbread for the stuffing. I'm excited.
Ooh. Real quick, let's go around. Favorite autumnal foods or Thanksgiving foods. Scott, can you start?
Oh man, it's dressing, stuffing, depending on your regionalism. But I learned something interesting, and listeners, if you know this to be true or false, please respond. Stuffing was created to go into the bird.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
But dressing came out of the Depression era in order to provide more bread, more food than you could stuff into a turkey, hence creating dressing on the side. But I don't know if that's true. That kind of makes sense to me. But
welcome to Dressing or Stuffing, the Dressing or Stuffing podcast. Yeah. No, this is great. That was great. No, Scottopedia, we love it.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Dressing or Stuffing, the Thanksgiving podcast.
CJ, what are your favorite Thanksgiving foods? Quickly, please.
Hash brown casserole. It's a Midwestern specialty.
Okay, mine's fried okra. Kev?
Sweet potato pie.
Yeah, that's the only you're right. I don't know why I didn't
I mean,
go dessert.
Don't make me pick. Right. Don't make me pick.
Yeah. This year I'm getting a pumpkin pie from Seed Bakery, my favorite bakery in Pasadena. They didn't have the sweet potato
sponsored
this year,
by.
So we're going
promo
pumpkin.
Code.
Non-spawn. hey, CJ, real quick before we get into it and introduce our guest. Siege, you saw a play I'm very jealous of. I'm going to go see it. But, you already saw it. A little pissed. That I wasn't invited, but it's fine.
I got offered a ticket. That's why.
It's fine, but you should have told them to offer it to me instead.
You could have gone with Scott Golden.
You're right, Scott Golden. Not this Scott, but Scott Golden.
Yeah,
invite me next time.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. Okay, you saw Clydes by Lynn Nottage.
Yes.
CJ and I's favorite playwright of the season, actually, that we covered.
Of all times for me thus far.
If you want to hear our entire rankings, you should go back and listen to our Curtain Call episode, which we just did last week. The Curtain Call episode rules. It is 90 minutes long, and we don't really get to the rankings until about an hour in, because we talked about Tar. We had to talk Tar.
And we had to talk about The Bulge.
And the Battle of the Bulge of Namor.
Namor's Bulge,
I want to marry him still. I want to marry him so hard.
Yeah, so that was fun. But Clydes, how was it?
Clyde's was fucking great. It's almost like a fanfic slash sequel to Sweat, which was super duper fun, especially cool. after we got done talking about Nottage and Sweat so much.
Interesting.
And it's surreal and it's funny. So like it's a departure from how I know her stuff to be, which was really fun. So yes,
I believe it's meant to be in a thematic trilogy with Sweat, but I don't know what the third one is. If this is the second or the third, I don't know. That's just what I had heard about it when it was coming out. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. Everyone go see it.
Used to be called Floyd's. Remember that? When we covered Lynn Nottage, it was called Floyd's when she first released it.
Oh, that's
it,
right. Yeah,
off Broadway. Oh. Now it's Clyde's. I don't know why. Don't know what the change was for. Anyway, welcome. Speaking of theater, welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
Wow, take your time. That's right, yeah. And each week, we get together to discuss, debate, and disseminate the works of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays. And this is a bonus mini-series that we do at the end of every season. The first season, I think we did his comedies. The second season, we did his tragedies. And now we are covering his histories. That's right, it's Shakespeare's histories. We're covering three of them. It's... I already forgot it. Hencast the sixth pod one. Here, I want a clean take of that. Hold on. No, I want a clean take of that. Hold on.
Okay.
Even if we leave this in, I just want a clean take for myself.
We're back to one.
That's right, folks. It's called Hencast the sixth pod one.
Yes.
Okay. I thought there would be cheers.
Good
in
job.
The
you said
there
folks.
Are. There are. We just
there were not.
Them.
No, it's fine.
No, you did fine.
Put them in post.
Good job, thanks. Bailey.
I've seen you do better. I've seen you.
I appreciate
do better.
It. Yeah, we're going to be covering three ever. Of his works. We're going to be taking a macro look at three of the histories. And this week all 3 weeks we are going to be joined by a very special guest. He is an LA. You already heard his voice, thankfully. Hey, Kevin, the sweet potato man.
Hello,
hey, Kevin.
he's an LA-based actor and producer. And he has performed musicals and heightened language comedies and Shakespeare all over the nation. He's also a dear new friend of mine. And his name's Kevin Shuey. Hey, Kevin.
That's me. Hello, I'm Kevin. I'm so excited to be here.
Welcome.
Good to have you.
Welcome.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Kevin. Kevin and I have been... on a trivia team together.
Yeah. Oh, fun.
and we won two weeks ago.
It was so exciting.
It was really
I've been going for months and I've never won before.
Yeah.
Is it just general knowledge?
Yeah. We've been going at the Federal in North Hollywood, not a sponsor of the
Federal.
I like their brunch.
their brunch is great. So we've been going there and it's been a good time.
Right on.
So, yeah.
I love bar trivia.
Someone else from our team who happens to be the romantic partner of Kevin was actually, her name's Kate. Heard her voice. Yeah, friend of the pod. She was actually on our Cyrano episode. I don't know if y'all remember that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But we had her on because I needed to give a counterpoint because...
Yeah, she disagreed with us.
Not even that. As much as just I knew going in that I was putting a lot of... I was putting a lot of juice behind it before y'all watched it. I was like, you're going to love it. You're going to love it. You're just going to enjoy it. And then I sat there like telling you how to enjoy it the whole time. Right. Not a lot of people are sitting with Bailey Burcham when they watch a movie like that. Okay. So sure. Kevin and Kate watched it on my recommendation. I was like, please, please watch this for me. Kevin, can you just give us a...
And we
brief...
hated it.
Yeah.
You're allowed.
Awful. So, you know.
Yeah.
We got into the whole, like, okay, if you're doing a remake of the original story, like, what are the essential elements that make it Cyrano? Does this movie include those? We didn't think it did. It went really deep. We did a whole thesis
all
on
right.
it. It's good.
Yeah, and when she came back to talk to me about it, we had, like, this beautiful, like, two-hour debate about it. And it was so healthy. And it was the first time in a long time I had had a healthy debate like that not on the podcast. And I was like, oh, she and I are going to be buddies. And then we were. And now I'm buddies with Kevin. And we've had some really healthy debates, movies, theater, otherwise. I'm hoping we can do that these next 3 weeks as well with these pieces. But
yeah,
I just liked the titties and silk.
We love titties and silk. Cyrano is all about the titties and silk. And the carbography. The carbography.
Which is worth the price of the admission.
Worth the price of admission. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So real quick, let me tell you what we're going to be covering the next 3 weeks. I sound like I'm echoing. Does everybody, is that just me? I'm going to take one ear off my headphones.
No,
okay,
you're.
Cool. I sound great? I sound beautiful as always?
No, you're having a stroke.
Amazing.
You're
having a stroke.
Why is your face twitching?
Why do I smell toast? Yeah. The next 3 weeks, we're going to be covering three pieces. We're going to be covering today, Henry VI, part one.
Part one.
The next week, we're going to be covering Richard II.
Yeah.
And not to confuse you at all, but then the next week, we're going to cover Henry V. Now, you might ask why we're doing the two Henry, doing Henry VI before Henry V. Well, technically, that's how they were written. That's the order they were written in. So we always go in chronological order. Scott, I have a quick question for you.
Yeah, you do.
Because I forgot to check before we started.
Yeah.
Do you have any Scottopedia for this? Or is this more of just, let's get into it?
I do.
Whoa.
Right on.
Now this is what I'm here for.
So I opted, the first season, as I recall, I did a formal,
this is born, died, da, 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 da.
Last year, it kind of was a mix and was kind of like funny made-up stuff. So this is just, I found this online from a Great British magazine.
Are we going to have a stanger?
Oh.
I mean, let him introduce it. I mean, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Wait.
Scottpedia.
All right.
You know what? I wasn't ready for it.
Wait, one more time?
Yeah, let's do that again.
Scottpedia.
So this is from Great British Mag .co.uk. So I went overseas to get the information. It's scholarly. No, here's your 10.
To use Google.
10 strange facts about Shakespeare.
Ooh, fun.
Shakespeare's will was slightly strange. The only thing Shakespeare left to his wife in his will was, does anybody know? No.
I can't remember. I've heard this before.
They're children. We were doing trivia tonight.
No. It was the second best bed in the house. His will reads, I give unto my wife my second best bed with the furniture. And by furniture, he meant the linens. Not other furniture in the bedroom, but there's some sort of poetry to that. And there's that Kenneth Branagh flick that kind of goes into it. Anyway, go see it.
Which Shakespeare flick with Kenneth Branagh in it?
It's the one that's about the last years of Shakespeare's life. And
so Michael Shaw Fisher's musical?
Yeah.
All is True? Is that what it's called?
All is True. That's it.
That's the name of it.
It's a charming little flick, and there's a great scene with Ian McKellen in it. And
did y'all ever see Anonymous? The movie Anonymous?
Yeah.
What's your take, Kev?
On the movie or the whole, like,
the movie, question? Not the debate on whether or not he actually
The movie was a very poorly presented, like, way to talk about the authorship question, which is dumb.
Yes.
It's dumb.
Okay. Now.
Oh, I'm not done yet.
He's got 9 more things to go through.
Yeah, these are the top 10 strange things.
I was about to comment on the bed, but go
ahead. Oh, my bad. My bad.
No, go ahead. Number two.
One of Shakespeare's relatives was executed. Edward Arden, a cousin of Shakespeare's mother, was arrested for reportedly plotting against Queen Elizabeth I. Although there was no clear evidence that he was actually involved, he was imprisoned in the Tower of London and executed. Boom.
Hot.
Number three, Shakespeare was not an Elizabethan playwright. Calling Shakespeare an Elizabethan playwright is actually incorrect. The majority of his plays were written after Queen Elizabeth I's death, making him a... Anybody want to shout
Cromwellian?
Close. Jacobian.
Jacobian.
Or Jacobean. However you want to say it. Number four, Shakespeare often wrote about suicide. Shakespeare seemed to be fond of one particular kind of death, and that was suicide. In fact, suicide occurs a whopping 13 times in Shakespearean plays.
How many of them are drowning suicides?
I think of one. Got one. Well,
sure. There's the most famous one. Yeah. I think it's the only one that is like that. I think the rest are all by dagger or
poison?
Or poison. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Poison.
Oh. Romeo and Juliet.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Okay,
no,
go.
No. It's good. two of Shakespeare's plays have been translated into Klingon. Klingon is the language created in the Star Trek science fiction series. You can read Hamlet or Much Ado About Nothing in the
Those were the
language.
Two I was going to guess.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess the,
I figure
Hamlet's
the
a
biggest tragedy,
sure.
The biggest comedy, arguably.
Yeah. Arguably.
There was a company that did a cut version of the Klingon Hamlet at Fringe like 10 years ago.
Okay.
It was interesting for about 10 minutes.
And then I was going to say, like, how long did that?
Okay. Like, all right, I got you. Some great costumes, though.
Did they do it in Star Trek garb? Was that the game?
Oh, yeah. It was a full Klingon story.
I don't know any Star Trek at all.
Yeah. That's
cool.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. Impressive.
Some moons were named after Shakespeare's characters. The moon circling around the planet Uranus. Hey, CJ, Uranus?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, are mostly named after
Your
characters from Shakespeare.
Kevin, in case you didn't know, mouths and butts are the same thing.
Didn't we say we're going to hit them hard? We're going to make all
next
of our guests uncomfortable?
Next season. Next right now, it's
like...
just... Let it go. Go ahead.
The moons of Uranus include Oberon, Ariel, and Juliet.
Which one has Ganymede? That's one of the moons of something.
That's,
I think, Jupiter.
Jupiter, right?
Yeah.
I think they both were inspired by mythic figures, though, so they were borrowing from the same source.
Yeah. Fair enough.
All the names of all the fucking everything. It was...
Yeah, eventually.
Planets and otherwise.
All
right, go ahead.
Eventually, you're going to get to The Simpsons. It's, you know, Bart.
Mr. Burns, the star.
Mr. Burns, the star.
Ned Flanders.
No one has dared to go close to Shakespeare's tomb since 1747. Shakespeare had a poem sketched into his tomb in Trinity Church, Stratford-upon-Avon. It says, "Anyone who moves his bones will be cursed." Consequently, his grave has gone untouched since 1747.
Oh, so
I think he was moved.
Think.
He was exhumed and moved. That's why it was 200 years later. One of Shakespeare's plays is never been performed by modern theater companies. One of Shakespeare's plays has been completely lost to history. There's evidence that he wrote a play called Cardenio, which was performed in England, but no known copy of the play exists.
Hmm.
Shakespeare never...
Sounds like bullshit to me.
Bullshit.
Yeah. I'm making a bullshit face.
GreatBritishMagazine.co.uk.
Hey, man. Hey, man.
Buggas.
There's records of the performance. There's just no records of the script. Okay. Shakespeare...
Bad.
What?
Maybe it was bad.
It's like, oh, we're not going to do that again.
He deleted it. He silenced it. He was like, "This, I'm not proud of this. Delete this.
This sucks. This, it was his Circus Valentine.
It's like
it was his Circus Valentine.
It's like Kubrick's first movie. Like, don't want nobody to see it.
Killer's Kiss.
No,
Fear and Desire.
Fear and Desire.
Yeah. They're both pretty bad. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, Killer's Kiss isn't great, but The Killing is. The Killing starts to get good.
Okay.
You
no, you're right. I have the. I'm looking at The Killing DVD right now.
Shakespeare never published any of his own plays. Thankfully, his friends did. Henry Candle and John Hemmings were the ones who posthumously, after his death, they got his stuff printed. Anyway,
great.
This is the last point. Does anybody know why Shakespeare started writing sonnets?
Because flirt, right?
What? To get laid? Yes.
No, it's because all the theaters shut down for the plague.
Boom! Kevin wins.
COVID-19.
You can do a sonnet by yourself. You can do a sonnet by yourself,
yeah. He literally just had no place to go.
They were one-man shows?
They were just one-man shows. Yeah. Anyway, so in Scottopedia.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Thanks for pulling that stuff up.
Yeah.
I love that. That was really fun. I appreciate it, Scott. You're a gentleman and a scholar.
I appreciate you.
Yeah, you do a really great job at looking stuff
up. Googling.
I'm just kidding. You're a great researcher.
No, I am not.
I know. I'm just talking shit. Okay. Let's do a tiny bit of context because the histories are. You can be a Shakespeare nerd and be somebody who says, but I don't fuck with the histories. I know people who say that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I kind of want to hear everybody's, like, just basic context slash feelings on the histories. Have you worked on any legitimately? Have you acted in any? You know, or I don't know. Go ahead. So let's start with our guest. Kevin, what's your context?
I love the histories. I think it's some of Shakespeare's best work. I also think it's some of his worst work, like the play we're talking about tonight.
Right?
Sure.
I love them. I think they're amazing. I've done a couple of them. I was working on a project before the pandemic to produce all 8 of them with the same cast. So see them all. Yeah, ridiculous.
Oh, and, that makes me pandemic. Let's talk after the show, Kevin.
Yeah, let's do it. It'll be cool. So I think they're amazing.
Who runs a theater company.
Yeah, I would love to chat. I think it's cool. And my context for this is like once I understood that these are like these are our current day version of The Crown, where it's like the people coming to see these shows would have known about some of these historical figures. And so if you think of the histories as like episodics in that way, all of a sudden they become much more cool, right? There's stuff in 6 where that you get to see in Henry V and all that stuff. So I love them. I'm a big nerd. I've read them a bunch and I've gotten to do a few of them.
Speaking of that, have you watched Hollow Crown?
Yeah, Hollow Crown's really interesting. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I've started watching a bit of it because I'm directing Henry VI Part 1 and 2 right now. With high schoolers. And so I've been watching some of it, but y'all go check it out. It's it has Sophie Okonedo as Margaret. She rules in it.
Yeah.
Cumberbatch is Richard III. Hiddleston is Prince Hal / Henry V, whatever. Anton Lesser of Game of Thrones and Andor fame. He rules on Andor. Is the Exeter or whatever. And I think Simon Russell Beale is like pops up as Falstaff and things like that, and it's like tells the whole Henryad saga, which is pretty rad. It's fun. Anyway, everyone should go check it out.
Highly recommend the Richard II with what's his name? Q. His name just left my head.
Of course, Watkins. It's Wishaw.
Ben Wishaw.
Yeah.
Does a great Richard II in that.
Yeah, he rules.
Really
It's very good.
It's very good. Very good. Yeah.
Okay, Scott. Context.
I have to say that I was introduced to the histories because of Branagh's Henry V. Mm-hmm. And when that came out, I was, you know, an early young teenager. And there was just this buzz around it and around him. Like, you know, it was kind of this, you know, big return of Shakespeare to cinema, you know, in big, you know, Laurence Olivier style thing. And so I remember watching it with my buddy. We went like, I think we had our parent, I think his mom dropped us off at the mall to go see it, like one of those deals. And I sat there and was like, I understand this, like this, I understand what's being said. So it really turned me on. Then I just, you know, studied most of them in college and got to do Hotspur in Henry IV Part 1, which was
cool.
Like, yeah, I fucking love that character.
Good and role.
It
good
is a role. Great role.
And then just scene work and scene stuff. So, you know, it's I wouldn't say I'm as entrenched with the histories, but I dig them. Like every time I revisit them, I dig them.
Sure. Siege?
I've seen Henry V live a time or two. I got to play Richmond in Richard III. I was the understudy, but I got 2 performances for that, and I loved it. But, I mean, I've seen scenes and monologues from all of them a billion times. I've used Henry monologues from Henry V several times for auditions because I love them. And actually, Henry VI Part 1 was my pick because I have always been obsessed with Joan of Arc, and I'd used some of her stuff from this play, but I'd never really kind of dove into it, which is why I picked it.
Rad. Yeah, I did Richard III in college, and I've talked about this on the pod before, but we did it post-apocalyptic, and they had blown out building on stage, two literal tons of sand and a flipped over truck. And so we were coming out of the sand as the ghosts and all this kind of stuff. And it was actually quite epic. It was in Kansas City and it had a lot of money behind it. And I really fell in love with it. And it was the first real Shakespeare I had tackled that I wasn't just reading. And from then on, started reading more and more of them, moved to Los Angeles, and that's not true. In Kansas City, I did a few other little Shakespeare pieces, but not histories. I moved to Los Angeles and became a teacher/director at Shakespeare Youth Festival. And now I have touched almost every one of the canon at this point in some way, which is kind of rad.
That is rad.
But I haven't been super involved with a lot of the histories, most of the Henriads. The year before COVID, I directed Henry IV Part 1, and we ended up, because we do 4-hour shows, we don't cut, they ended up wanting to extend a little bit, so we added a little bit of Falstaff stuff from Part 2 into Part 1, because we had a really great Falstaff.
Fun.
Things like that. I've done Lear, which I guess, does that count? I'm talking more legit histories, though. I guess I've really only touched the Henriads because Richard III, and I directed on Zoom during the pandemic. I've seen King John told in a Appalachian backwoods with a bunch of middle schoolers. It was cool.
Right,
it was
on.
Good. It worked. Yeah. They had they were playing on washboards and shit. It was really fun. Blowing into liquor bottles to make
with Doug, the X's Doug's on them.
It was funny. It was
Doug
good.
Mans.
We enjoyed it.
Yeah, sure.
I guess that's where I'm at with it. I'm currently directing Henry VI Part 1, which is what we're talking about today. It is a heavily cut up, it's a bit chopped and screwed. We have...
I feel like there's some scenes you can do that with this play.
For sure. For sure. We've also done some things and we'll get into this, but Salisbury dies... And then he gets stabbed in the eye and I assume dies. And then 30 pages later, it says Salisbury. And you're like, who is that? Turns out it's his son, but they don't really clarify that. And so you have to kind of do all this context stuff.
They all keep dropping real fast.
There's four Somersets. There's 9 Gloucesters. I'm just kidding. But it's that kind of thing. And so we're dealing with a lot of issues there. We're dealing with a lot of, and this will get us into sort of the discussion is, there's so many characters.
So many.
And that can be a problem with the histories, but this one is there's 30 sentinels, right? There's 20 messengers, and there's, in which you can, with a cast of 15, which is all we have, we're doing a lot of everybody plays 100 roles, right? But
right.
We're also doing 2 nights. You have to come 2 nights to see the whole show. We're
like
pulling
an
inheritance or Angels in America. Revengers comedies.
To eat so many gummies and come to both nights.
Please
do.
I'm really stoked about this. I have, and no hate to any, or no negativity to any of my other casts. This is the first cast where I have felt the most passion. We came in the week after giving them their scripts, and I was blocking a scene, and almost all of them already knew their lines in the scene. That's crazy.
That's crazy. That's awesome.
That's crazy. So
they're
these kids
are professionals.
Total theater nerds. Yeah, they're not theater nerds, excuse me, they're Shakespeare nerds. They're constantly correcting me and doing all this stuff. But let's get into it. There's a lot of characters, there's a lot of shit going on, and it can make it hard to know exactly what the plot is. Now, CJ, I don't need you to break down every moment of
this
plot.
Don't worry,
this
is beautiful.
Thank you. But let me hear it.
CJ's breakdown.
Kevin stole one of my favorite jokes, but I'm going to reread it again.
Fine.
After the untimely HP 2100 Oregon Trail style death of Henry V, dysentery, England finds itself in a power vacuum due to a way too young king taking the throne and a ton of dudes arguing that they have the country's best interests at heart. While all fighting amongst themselves, the French Dauphin, Charles, is introduced and bolstered by a young maid, Joan of Arc, who leads his armies to several victories. Who wins? Who will the boy king marry? Is Joan actually a virgin? I mean, history has already told us, but this is definitely the fun dramatized version with many a liberty taken. Think of it as The Crown for Elizabethans or Jacobians. As I've just
Jacobians. Yeah.
Kevin, when you said job. The Crown, I was like, damn it! I thought that was joke. Brilliant.
Oh, should have done Game of Thrones, and because that's the other.
Well, and damn it, that's the other thing I had in my notes.
I'm stealing your jokes all over the place.
You're
I'm so
stealing
sorry.
My bits. No,
I'm so sorry.
You're faster than me. You win.
We should at the top here should mention two interesting things about this play. A, this is early Shakespeare. This may be his first play.
Probably the first, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
Yeah.
You can feel it a bit.
That he, there's a lot of scholarship that suggests he did co-write this. He probably, Marlowe was probably somebody he spent time with. And you can see it. Somebody pointed it out years ago. It's really the roses scene, the picking the roses scene that you go, that's sure. Shakespeare, that's him, like yeah. where it's clear as a bell. But it's a fucking mess of a show. Like, that's the other thing is it's just, it's historically like interesting. And when we get into the Joan of Arc stuff, I think Shakespeare's take is so awesome and so British and so dismissive. And
it really is.
And, which is fine by me because she was a zealot and was probably a
we'll get into it. But yeah. it is it's weird for how epic it is. It is quite elementary in some ways. However, there's a piece that we've been picking up on in rehearsals a lot that every scene really has like a solid button at the end. Whereas sometimes in Shakespeare, I don't feel that as much. He has his scenes that do, obviously, especially
sure,
that
sure.
end with the monologue or whatever it may be. But almost every scene has like a line that you're kind of like, ooh, yeah, that's the end of the scene. You know, there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of comedy in here. We've been finding it every day. To speak to it, there's a scene that is basically the French and the English having a Monty Python and the Holy Grail
farted
in your general direction moment. Like, I mean, literally, they're up on the walls being, ha ha, you, I'm stupid. He's like, come fight me for real. And they're like, no. This shit's hilarious. That was offensive. I'm sorry. I shouldn't do it. But
I think that scene with the Countess of Auvergne is like super funny too, where she's Talbot, and he's like, don't think so.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's comedy in that.
It might be partly the actor that's playing him, but the Dauphin is really funny. He's got a lot of like where he's like, yeah, screw you, Joan, you whore. And then she's like, you want to fight? And he's like, no, I'm good. You're fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of that. There's some good stuff.
I love the
here.
First scene when she comes in and she's like, my name's Joan. And she explains why she's so powerful. And then he goes, great. Do you want to like fuck or something?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's into her.
Some things never change.
Yeah. Yeah. The French are real horny in this. Real horny.
Listen.
Yeah.
Yeah. The French
it's
are
the
real
bread
horny.
And cheese and all that wine.
It's all that
in fact,
wine. My babies
all
need
the
wine.
The French characters in general tend to have a bit of like, and it's because of the perspective, I think, in some ways, but
sure.
There's a bit of comedy behind all of them. Dauphin, the Bastard of Orléans, Alençon, Régnier. I've never taken French. I'm making shit up. But they can all be played with like a bit of comedy to them. And the French tend to be a bit funnier than the English. And I think that's a bit of like a...
Oh, yeah, the English are the heroes in this. Or they're the good guys.
I mean, yeah, he's... And listen, it would be, you know, an audience would have eaten that up. Any mockery of the French would have been like...
Yes.
At that time, they just would... Well, even today. Even today, you know, you can make fun of the French...
I mean, I think that's the whole... I think that is the whole sort of frame behind the way that this play addresses Joan of Arc is like, you are supposed to laugh at her. She's supposed to be, this is the French war hero. And we're just being like, nah, she's real dumb. Like, yeah. It's all, she flip-flops at the end like crazy. We'll get into it, as we say.
The summer I studied abroad in London was the summer that London got picked for the 2012 Olympics. And the race was between London and Paris. And then, like, 5 days after London got it, that was when the King's Cross bombing happened.
Oh, shit.
And I was back in London, like, 2 days after that happened, and the joke around town was that the French did it.
Jesus. God damn it.
I mean, it was a joke, but yeah.
No, they wouldn't have.
Because they didn't get the Olympics.
They got it the next year, right? Were they in 2016? I can't remember. Anyway. I don't know where I'm at now.
Me neither, Bailey, honestly. Go ahead.
I want to go back to something you said about, like, buttons at the ends of scenes.
Yeah.
Which, I feel that, but I think, this show is very rarely produced, and when it is, it's often cut up and it's put together, and I think that's because the scenes are not, like, sort of don't stack up to each other, right? Like, mm-mm. I think you see in a lot of other Shakespeare plays where it's like, of course, the next scene is this. Of course, the next scene is that. And this play doesn't have it. It's like, correct. We talk for a minute, and then there's a big battle. And then we come in, and we're like, wow, what a battle. And then there's another fight. And then we're out, and we're back to England. Right, right.
The amount of work we're having to do to not tell the story that it tells is profound. right? Like, the amount of times we're having to go, okay, and then there's a huge battle, but what if it's not that? What if it's just...
A slap fight.
An interaction. What if it's a dumb show? I don't know, you know.
The other reason why I thought maybe this isn't produced that much is the set pieces and the battles and the sheer amount of, like, tech stuff you have to have and roll out onto stage. And, yeah, those big battles that happen in between, like, in the middle of a scene. I was like...
Oh, yeah.
And clearly it was a superior donut-style scene change.
Right. Yeah, nice reference.
nice Tracy Letts reference.
Yeah, good one. And then the other thing, and we've been talking about this recently with other stuff, but whose play is this? Like,
I wrote down that question. I was like, who is the main character of this play?
I know the answer. Do you want to know the answer?
Who?
This is Talbot's play.
Yeah, kind of.
I think so.
I think he is the personification of all the themes.
He guides the only action.
Right. Yes, and he's, you know, because we start...
I mean, in a lot of ways.
We start with the death of Henry V, who is a hero.
Yeah.
And now it's, and he's, you know, there's also, he's setting up two sequels, you know, arguably. Like, what do you do?
It's very Empire Strikes Back at the end of this, I felt like.
Because and he kind of, and he's got to cheat because the real Henry VI was 9 months old when Henry V died. So they're like pushing the timeline a little, because I remember... Like, I've seen scenes where it's like an adolescent kid, like an 11, 12-year-old that's doing it, as opposed to a child, which is how it's described in the play. But in real life, it was just a damn baby that, you know, that everybody...
Just a damn baby.
That everybody was going to fight over it, you know? And,
but he's even written as just this sort of child, frail...
Idealistic.
And everything he's saying is going, please don't fight.
That's exactly. That was the impersonation I was going to do. It's like,
but it's what gives Margaret her ability to go, I can work with this.
I can
control and manipulate this. And that's why she, interesting.
I also think that, like, allows for the people around Henry to be some, like, really interesting storytelling there.
For sure.
Bedford and Gloucester and Exeter are all, like, the brothers and uncles and, like, really close family members of Henry. So it's like, which of them is actually rooting for the king? Which of them is, like, trying to manipulate their own way into power?
I would argue the only person, and we should get into characters, because I think the only person that is actually truly saying what he means the whole time is really, of those people you just listed is Bedford, Henry V's brother.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is with Talbot out in the field as he's dying.
Yeah.
He's like, they're like carrying him around. He's like,
just spitting blood.
I'll be fine, just leave me here. And they're like, can we please take his horse? Like, it's fine, I'll die here. For the country, you know. Let's go through the characters a little bit, because there's a thousand, but let's just start here. Do you have like a favorite? We talked to Talbot a tiny bit. We can get a little deeper. I think Talbot's my guy.
I think Talbot's my guy. He's the moral center. He's the one that stands up for everything that is uniquely English. He is, you know, the last sort of bastion of Henry V's reign. He's heroic and noble. When everybody else starts getting, horny to try and figure out how they're going to position themselves, he's the one that's like, you know, doing his duty and sticking to it. And that scene with his son is crazy.
Yeah, it's.
You mean the three scenes with the son where
yeah,
the
it's
same
overwritten.
Thing happens every time?
We literally cut two of them. Yeah, because it's overwritten there. And there's a lot of that here. There's a lot of just like, let's show Salisbury talking to somebody that about something that doesn't really help us with anything here. There's a lot of that. Kevin, favorite characters?
This is a weird pick. I love Talbot. I'm going to go with Exeter. I think Exeter is like old guard, right? This is the Exeter from Henry V. He was Henry V. He was a part of that. And we just get, like, he just gives us these, like, cool little insights at the ends of scenes in a couple of spots. Mm-hmm. So I think he's, like, really smart and is sort of, like, guiding a lot of this action. If I was playing him, that's what I'd do is I'm like, get everybody
nice
to do what I want.
Nice, yeah.
Siege, do you have a favorite character? Do you have anybody that you're, like...
I have two. Joan of Arc. I want to redo this play. I want to direct this play and make her the hero that gets fucked over in the end by
Satan.
Bad. My other favorite one is the third serving man. He goes to the bar after the rock fight.
Sure. let's talk Joan, since you brought her up.
Go ahead.
I know everybody has a bit of
Well, what's
Joan
your favorite character?
Talbot.
I
think... I honestly, and I have some other favorite, like, smaller characters. I think Burgundy is so morose and, like, always just like, everything is awful. And they're like, okay, Burgundy's like, I think he's funny. He's just so sad. But that actually goes to the English are always very serious and the French aren't as much. Joan, though... What you just said, Siege, we have this graduated student who actually played Richard III during the lockdown in my production. He has graduated and he still is a counselor for the rehearsals. And so he comes by and helps. And he wanted to be part of the cutting of Henry VI, part one. And so while we were cutting it, he was like very adamant. He was like, we have to change it. We have to cut all of the negative context, and we have to make her the hero. We have to. He really, really believed this.
Mm-hmm.
And he convinced the artistic director, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, at first I was sort of, because I didn't really know this piece as well. I had only maybe engaged with it once. I was like, okay. But then I read the cut, and I was like, this doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. At all. Like, there's no way to really do it, because... At the end of the day, which I think I've heard you say as well, CJ, she was, especially to the English, she was a troubled person. And no matter what whether she was really dealing with all this stuff or not, but she has been portrayed... especially in British, European, and American pop culture, as a hero in almost everything I've ever seen her in.
Yeah.
And I'm not arguing you. I'm just saying, like, I think to try to make her the hero in this would be very difficult and would end up sort of just telling a story that's already been told rather than giving the other side of it, which is the nugget of interest I have with this plot. That's the nugget I have. I think it's still messy and not great and kind of unproducible as I'm finding out day by day.
Yeah, no, listen, I love the myth, the mythology of Joan of Arc. I love the legend of Joan of Arc. I love the whole idea of a young woman putting on armor and going into battle and fighting just as hard or better than the men. That's what I like about her.
Yeah, or helping Bill and Ted. Like, she does it all.
Well,
yeah.
And I mean, like, there's, I keep harping about Ennui, who's a French playwright that wrote The Lark, which is a positive view of her, or like Shaw's Saint Joan. I mean, there's plenty of works out plays
Brecht
out there
did
that do
three
that.
Joan of Arc stories,
that
all
I
where
need
she
to
was
fucking
the
read
hero.
Now.
Yeah.
But no, I'm also like, I know you mentioned as you guys were getting ready to produce this that you were talking about making it a mental health type of thing, which to me is fascinating as well. I just think she has yummy, wonderful speeches in it, especially the one where she calls out to the demons to help her win the battle. Like, they're just great fucking speeches. And I feel like she's the one, especially because they make so much fun of the French in this play, she's the one in the middle of all of them, like the one scene where the English take back the town and all of the French come out and they're like, what happened, Joan? It's your fault. She said, no, it's not. You guys fell asleep at the wheel. Like, I feel like she's the one lesser idiot in the pack of idiots on the French side in this play. And I just like her. I don't think she's actually the hero. I just like Joan of Arc characters. That's all.
I think the way Joan is treated in this is like, for me, is one of the reasons that I think this is, I'm going to say it, I think this is Shakespeare's worst play. This is him and who, if he had collaborators, those as well, like, they're like, I know what the audience wants. They want to see sword fights and they want to shit on the French.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is pure populist storytelling. So the structure is built around, we want to take this French hero and go, she was crazy and she didn't really even believe her own bullshit, right? Like, that is inherent to the way the story is told. And I think if you change it, the whole sort of through line of the French sort of doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't land anywhere. It doesn't resolve without that part of it. So I don't think it will work if you sort of flip her around and make her a hero.
But also, like, there's so many things about this play too that it's like, we talk about it all the time, a lot, especially these political plays or historical plays, that it's like, time is a circle, nothing really changes. And the thing that struck me about this play is both sides are saying, well, the other side's winning because they're friends of Satan. Like, both sides say that about one another in this play, and guess what, that hasn't fucking changed.
Right.
By the way, we haven't cut any of the occult stuff with where she goes into the woods. It's all there.
Best
we were like,
part.
Yeah, fuck it. This is
great. It's great.
Gloucester's wife. Yeah, like, it rules.
It's great.
Gloucester. We haven't talked Gloucester and York. Can we talk a bit of Gloucester and York?
Yeah.
I was confused about which Richard he was. I had to text Scott about it.
He's two.
No.
Who
no,
is
no.
he then?
He's one of the cousins named Richard. They're all named Richard.
Right. Okay. Well, because it's confusing because Richard III becomes Gloucester.
Right.
Yes. Go ahead, Kevin.
So I think this is really important, and once you figure this out in the histories, it'll help you a lot.
Sure.
Great.
Names like Gloucester and Bedford and Exeter, they are titles. They are the duke of those places. So when it switches, what you were talking about with, you just mentioned it, that it's the
Richard
son...
Third becomes Gloucester. Talbot? Bedford? What are you talking about?
I forget. We were talking about
York
one earlier. That was
became Gloucester.
Yeah,
Gloucester,
so it's like,
York
it's the
something.
Son now, and they're still just calling him York, and you're like, who is this? I don't know.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Like, even in Richard III, the play, they go back and forth between calling him Gloucester, Richard, and then there's another name they call him.
Region.
Plantagenet.
York still?
Plantagenet.
Oh, Plantagenet. Yeah. That was, he was called Plantagenet in this play too.
Yes. Yeah. So
whatever
the Gloucester,
Richard
Plantagenet
is.
Gloucester, I
That's
think, is
different...
the title.
Yeah.
Right?
Plantagenet
is the last name.
So,
So this...
Richard is his first name. That's Richard.
Yeah.
Gloucester is his title. That is like, he is the Duke of Gloucester, or becomes it later, not in this play. And then Plantagenet is the branch of the family tree.
Got it. Right. Got it.
Which
it's
goes
the Plantagenet
back
cousins.
To Richard II. The Plantagenets were related to Richard II, so they lost all of their titles and stuff when Richard II was usurped. We'll get to that next week.
But it's also why there are multiple Suffolk and multiple Somersets.
Because Rich... Go ahead.
I have a quick question. Not when it was written. Chronologically, where does Richard II fall in relation to Henry VI, Part One?
Richard II is the first one. It's Richard, Henry IV, Part One, Henry IV, Part Two, Henry V.
Oh, okay.
But that's Richard's considered its own tetralogy.
Yeah. The Richards are bookends. Okay, great.
Richard III gets introduced in Henry VI, Part Two.
Right.
Yes.
And it's like a big moment. And then he...
Yes.
And then the next play is his story, the final of this...
Henry VI, Part Three.
Seven.
No, he shows up in Part Two, then continues
in
Part
Two.
But three is when he steps out.
Three is when you start to notice, yeah.
And then after Part Three is Richard III?
Yeah.
Yes. But it's the only time... There's a time jump because...
3,500 years?
Well, because it's... Like, no,
it's not
because,
that long, though.
No, but there's a king and there's Edward the Fourth or something is in between Henry VI and Richard.
I was looking at like actual king timelines from England throughout this.
It gets wacky, and then where I got confused was this weekend while I was working, I was doing my research, so I had the play up on one side of my screen, and then the Wikipedia about the guy on the other side, and I'm like, well, a lot of this
don't
just isn't matching up.
Like,
yeah, it just was, you know, it's sometimes surprising because sometimes you'll read through like the one of those biographies and go, oh, well, Shakespeare wasn't too far off, you know, it was this and that, and you know, I guess the characterization of Henry VI is pretty accurate, that he was sort of pious and shy and he didn't like fighting, and he didn't like the politicking. He just wanted everybody to be good and friends. And
Shakespeare plays, not only is he like riffing on actual historical facts and like amalgamating characters into his plays, but he can be inconsistent with his own canon. Bit with Mortimer in this play, he's talking about like, we do see those traitors in Henry V, but Mortimer sort of is like, they were trying to instill me as king. And if you go back to Henry V, you're like, nobody said anything about that, Mortimer.
Right.
Well, but this was before he would have written this one, before he would have written Henry V, you know.
It's so then he really shouldn't have fucked it up.
Exactly.
He could have gone back. Yeah, prequels. By that point he couldn't have remembered, because Henry V is written a chunk later in terms of time.
It's the last of the histories. It's like right smack dab in the middle of all of Shakespeare's canon.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay.
The War of Roses. I know there's the big scene where they're ruining the fucking rose bushes in the royal garden or whatever.
And the red
roses. That actually how that fucking started? Or where did the War of Roses come from? Do they know? Or was Shakespeare like, I'm going to write this scene and explain it? Or what?
No, it was part of the sigils that eventually got assigned to each clan of families that were...
A white rose and a red rose.
A white rose and a red rose. It was really that simple.
York.
At some point, people literally just had to pick, so they would, you know, display a rose. And...
Well, I thought there was like something that happened in history.
No, it wasn't. No, it was literally that simple.
Kevin, do you know?
I actually want to talk about this moment because, the thing that sets off the War of the Roses in this play happens off stage, and we actually we don't know what it is. They just
Vogel
Somerset
write that
and
play.
And
yeah.
Somerset and you know, the crew come in and they're like, do you agree with me? And like, we're off to the... But we sort of never get a sense of what that thing is, right? It becomes about succession and who has a stronger claim to the throne and whatnot. But there's this like dumb legal thing that kicks off the whole thing and we don't know what it is.
You know, the whole thing is fascinating, and the crown analogy is really great. And I think that that's a way to kind of go, this is sensationalized. Like, I think people approach the histories as, oh, he's teaching me something. He's really not. He's having a good time, and he's writing, you know, like Kevin said, populist shows, you know, and patriotic shows.
Mm. Yes.
And then, you know, there's also sort of the, you know, he's definitely trying to appease Elizabeth early on. He's definitely trying to appease King James later on, and so it's an interesting juggling act that he does as a performer. I mean, he was a great politician, Shakespeare was. So
mm-hmm. Something that Kevin had brought up that I definitely agree with, it definitely does give off a Game of Thrones vibe.
Yeah.
The first couple seasons in that it is all just the leadership. It's all the people on top making all these decisions, and you don't really see how it's affecting the people underneath. We get some glimpses with the fucking rock fight in the street, but like, there's other histories where he gets better about showing the common man in that too, right?
Well, the themes change a lot too. I think he does that really with Henry IV, Part One,
yeah.
And with Richard too, with Bolingbroke in general. This idea, because Richard II going into Henry IV, not to digress too much, but he was really commenting on a change in what the monarchy was supposed to be. Richard II was a throwback to the medieval ages. I'm anointed by God. I am a superhuman. I am above everybody else. And Bolingbroke comes in and goes, no, leadership and being king is about your connection, also about serving your people. It's about service as well. So there's, you know, he gets into what that entails. And I mean, Henry IV's rise is kind of about a common man. I mean, they're middle class. He's not super high up on the wall.
But I also guess that's what's sexy. I mean, Kevin, you were talking about, we want to make fun of French people and we want to have battle scenes, but also like the people coming and paying to see the show probably would much rather watch the lives of the rich and wealthy that they could never possibly like
totally
imagine in their own lives.
Totally. Yeah. It's a soap opera. I mean, it's a soap mm-hmm. opera.
That's what I was going to say, is like the history of the characters is important too. It's why I was so excited about like doing all of the shows together, is because you're like, why is the bishop being a dick? Well, because there's this whole history of this family.
Yeah.
That, like, if you're privy to it, and you might have been if you were a theater-going Londoner at the time, and then he really covers it in the other plays. So if you've mm-hmm. got that history to back up these characters, first of all, it clarifies all these fucking bajillion different characters we've got on stage, but you know, it just makes the stories that are being told so much richer, because you're mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, that guy killed that guy's dad, so that's why he's pissed off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, watch what's gonna happen.
I think that
very
was
soap
kind
opera-y.
Of the one really cool thing about that Hollow Crown series was that was sort yeah. of an attempt to kind of, let's use all these people. Let's keep this through line of who these identities are and who these families are and how the families rise and fall.
Yeah. There's this fucking scene in the Hollow Crown where they're talking about somebody and you kind of don't know who they're talking about. And they're like, oh, here he is on his way. And in silhouette, we see a young, maybe like 15-year-old guy with a hump coming in, kind of wobbling in. And it's like an end game drop. It's like the end yeah. of a Marvel yeah. movie. Like, oh
shit.
These are Shakespeare's Marvel movies.
It's like, fill me in a little bit on Hollow Crown.
It's Hollow this Crown whole was story told on BBC. It's all the people I listen to.
It's all
to
the Shakespeare plays individually done under the series
histories.
Title, The Hollow Crown.
Oh, okay.
And it goes from Richard II through.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier with Sophie
right,
Okonedo
no, yeah.
and Cumberbatch and Hiddleston. Yeah, it's just, it's the Henry ad.
Oh, okay.
They don't do Henry 6 part 3.
That's
oh, that's right.
They
that's
do
right.
the whole rest of the set.
Right.
It's cool. It's interesting. It's very much a style. It's sort of like British film actors
yeah.
in the late 2000s.
Yeah.
So the tone is a little wonky sometimes, but it's very good. And if you are new to the histories, it is a great way to get, like,
boy, maybe I should watch those.
It contextualizes them really well. Like, I don't know. I feel like especially with movie versions of Shakespeare, sometimes I feel like they're not actually telling the story better. Like, that's yeah. kind of how I felt about, this is awful because I know a lot of people really loved it. I thought the performances were incredible. But the new Coen Mackers with
yeah.
Denzel Washington. It was very vast and it was very beautiful and the cinematography was very cool, but I walked out being like, I think I understand this play less than I did before, and I understand this play very well. I've directed this play.
We could do a whole podcast on Shakespeare adaptations. And
yeah. We should. I think we absolutely should. Next season, that might be one of our, that's something we really tackle. Because there's so many of them. We've talked about a lot on this series, or on this podcast.
Talked about
but...
Much Ado, Titus.
Yeah. She's All That.
West Side Story.
Yeah.
I meant She's the Man, not She's All That. She's the Man. 12th Night.
Here's my 90 seconds on that, and I think it's applicable to the histories and this show in particular.
Yeah.
I think these stories come alive when you understand the history of the characters and the history and the actual history that Shakespeare is playing with.
Yeah.
I think that enhances these stories so, so much because it gets you a little closer to what somebody who is seeing this for the first time it was performed, would have known and experienced. I think an adaptation that gets you closer to that experience, and I'm not necessarily talking about like it needs to be original, you know, Jacobean costumes and whatnot,
sure.
But just the understanding of the social structures and the political themes that are going on there is a great adaptation because it gets you closer to that original intent. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times in Shakespeare adaptations, you actually get farther away because you're putting a concept on it.
Right.
And sure. I would say, totally agree. Do you know the Ian McKellen, Richard III? That's set, I believe, in World War One.
World War Two.
Is it two?
Yeah.
I think it's one.
Is it one?
Yeah, it's one.
I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's World War One. But that one, which is not set in the context of anything that Jacobean or anything of that nature, fully gets the hierarchies and the histories in a way that you can comprehend. And I don't even know the history of everything that's going on there, right?
Yeah, right.
Because what is it? It's like World War One and he's in
World War One,
set in the 1930s. I just looked at
1930s. Oh, okay. Okay,
so in between, we're all
nobody's right here.
But the rise of German fascism and Hitler Nazism.
Yeah, things like that. So you're right, Kevin. I think that's interesting. I'm trying to think of more adaptations that work, but maybe we save it. Maybe we do this at another time. Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, hate me all you want, the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet gets this
one. No, we love that one on this podcast.
We talked about it
last year, I think.
I get why people dislike it, but I think it really clarifies a lot of the social and societal structures
absolutely does.
Of R&J.
I think, as of 2 days ago, because I had a conversation about Baz Luhrmann, I think it's his best movie.
Fuck Elvis.
I agree.
It is his best movie, to be clear.
I mean, people love Moulin Rouge, you know, and Strictly Ballroom.
I like Moulin Rouge
amazing.
A great deal. Strictly Ballroom rules.
Yeah.
I think Great Gatsby and Elvis need to be deleted.
Elvis made me mad.
And Australia. Don't forget Australia.
Well, I forgot about Australia. Go ahead, Kev.
I want to take us back to the play because we can't leave without talking about this Talbot scene. Talbot and John Talbot. I've told you, I think this is Shakespeare's worst play. This is one of his best scenes. It's long, but what it does with language here is like so iconic of Shakespearean rhetoric and like what was happening with language in the theater at the time. Mm. And it's something I always talk about when people who are new to Shakespeare and are like struggling with iambic pentameter and rhyming couplets and all this, I say this is iconic in that this is this idea that they are both fighting for their idea, which is like, I'm going to stay, you go, so you can live, right? This is, for anybody who hasn't read this recently, the Talbots sort of get
spoilers.
Like hedged in. And they're like about to get fucked by the French. And Talbot's son comes in and is like, Dad, you go so you can live. I'll stay here and fight. The dad goes, No. You're the son. You run off. I'll stay and fight. And they do this this sort of word battle in rhyming couplet.
Shall my youth be guilty of such blame?
Yeah. And it's this whole idea that not only does your idea have to be right, but the way that you say it has to kick ass. And the best idea said in the best way is the idea that will win. Ultimately, they tie. I think they're sort of evenly matched in their wordplay and their rhetoric.
Right.
But I love that scene so much. I think it's a really great scene.
It's really beautiful. Yeah. That's one of the other scenes.
And then he dies.
Then he dies. That's one of the other scenes that scholars are like, that's Shakespeare. Like, this all might have been co-written or rewritten. The roses scene,
he
and
did
this
that scene.
And that scene. He's like, that's Bill. That's but Bill it's, Shakespeare.
It's sort of like, and I think I've brought this up in the past miniseries, but it is sort of why I think it's easy to compare him with someone like Eminem, right? Where you can hear a verse done by somebody else and know it's written by Eminem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's a certain flow, it's a certain style, it's a certain cadence in a lot of ways. And even if you're not, if he's not the one saying it, you can feel it. And this is kind of the epitome of that in a lot of ways. And I think that's why it's easy to point at that and go, oh, that's Shakespeare, right? That's Eminem. He wrote that verse for that person. What else? Is there another scene that you think is worth anything at all? Discussion. But like, what I really mean is like, you know, that you say this is his worst play, but maybe this is one of his best scenes. Is there anything else that stands out to you like that?
I think talking Margaret figuring it out to go after that, that's some cool stuff. That's some cool
Margaret work. Has some pretty solid speeches in this.
Yeah.
Actable speeches is what I mean. I don't even mean that they're like so beautifully written, but for an actor are very fun to do.
Yeah.
Joan has a few too.
Yeah.
I just say, and to CJ's point, Joan's speeches are incredible.
They rock.
I just love witchy speeches. They're fun.
Love sure.
Yeah.
I think the other interesting thing about Margaret is how she's playing it. We see all the men politicking, and then we see, because she doesn't hold any titles. She's not royal. Like, this is a play for, this is a huge fucking play. And that she does it so well. And it's like, you know, it's like Henry, like, okay, like, you know, you're going to be my wife. It's fucking hilarious and awesome.
Is there anything else we want to tackle about Henry VI, part one today? Now, a reminder that for the next 2 weeks, we'll be covering things that are in this story. They're all connected. So we can always come back if we go, oh, fuck, there's this thing I want to talk about. But last chance, before I ask you one final question, is there anything else you guys want to discuss, debate, or disseminate?
I do want to, like, put a pin in this because I'm going to want to talk about it in Henry V.
Yeah.
That, and I alluded to it earlier, that Mortimer speech where he's talking to Richard and is like, hey, here's what happened. We're going to get to see that in Henry V, and I want to talk about it because I love that moment. So I just want to call it out for the regular podcast listeners.
Right. That's great. That's great. And when we do Henry V, I want to talk a lot about Prince Hal, Henry IV.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, specifically Prince Hal, who is Henry V, but you know what I mean. No, excuse me. Prince Hal, who is Henry IV, a lot.
What?
Stay with me. Prince Hal, who is in Henry IV, Henry V.
There you go.
Correct.
You know
it.
What I mean.
Yeah, you got it.
Woo! It's been a long day.
Proud of you,
bro. No, yeah, because I know Henry IV way better than Henry V. Even rereading it for this, I keep being like, right, I've only seen that movie.
Both parts? Both Henry IV, part one and
I do.
Two?
Okay. I do, because I've directed them both. We cut a lot from part two, but I read them both to, like, get into them, and I know them pretty well. I just don't know Henry V, though. I've never seen it on stage. I've seen Henry IV, part one and two multiple times, actually. I saw them at Oregon Shakespeare Fest in, like, 2017, I want
to
say.
What place to see him?
Two nights, you'd come see part one, you'd come see part two. It was in the round. It was epic. Hotspur was this phenomenal actress, and it was just this, like, it was hardcore. It ruled. And the Falstaff was absolutely genius, and then passed away like a few months after the show closed, which was nuts. Last quick thing. Fastolf. Fastolf is a real person, and apparently who Falstaff is actually based on.
Yeah.
But they're not the same character in the plays.
Correct. No.
No.
Weird.
Well, and Falstaff was a real hero. Like, he was a real, like, war hero who fought that he Shakespeare messes with a little bit there.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was accused of treason. Like, there were English lords who were like, this guy's a coward. So it depends on who you believe, right, historically speaking.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think, you know, Falstaff obviously is like one of the coveted roles, and a lot of I've played him, but not in a Shakespeare play. I played
He's the
Falstaff.
Bottom of the histories.
Yes, there's an opera of Falstaff. I played Falstaff in a play called, it was my first thing I booked in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. It was called Outspoken. And it was
I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, it's about all of Shakespeare's characters who were imprisoned as if they were imprisoned together. Mm. And in the clink. And it's Joan and Falstaff and Jack Cade and no, it's like the really big ones. And then the ghost of Juliet lives in the cell with them, and it's actually really and Hamlet's there. But the ghost of Juliet and Hamlet, that's it, that's what it is. The ghosts of Juliet and Hamlet live inside the cell. It's good. It's interesting. Is it? Well, I won't say that. Never mind. The playwright probably listens to the podcast. It was great. It was so fun. That's all I'm going to say.
So fun, yeah.
It was the first thing I booked in LA. You get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. I love you, all three of you, so deeply. Listeners, I love you. I think it's time to do our closing out shit, unless you guys have anything else you want to say.
Do we want to do our spitlets? I've got nothing more.
Yeah, that's the closing out shit.
Well, there's the closing out, and then there's the LA spotlight, and I've always recognized them as two different aspects of the script.
Okay, well.
When are you guys going to just kiss and get it over with?
We do it all the time.
Probably
there's
Friday,
a lot of tension going on right here.
Yeah, we do open mouth kissing practice at least once a week, so
yeah,
you're wrong.
Yeah, it's just practice, though.
Oh, you're way that sounds off like fun.
It's nothing, fun. Nothing gay about it.
I have no spotlights, but we should do spotlights. LA spotlights. Kevin, this is for us to talk about anything local in Los Angeles that we want to shout out or spotlight, and then we'll get to things you personally might want to shout out. But first, do you have anything you know of that's going on? I want to hear the stinger first, though. Hold on.
LA spotlight.
You got anything, Kev?
I don't know if this is the vibe, but I saw Inheritance Parts 1 and 2 a couple weekends ago.
Oh, yeah?
It's
pretty great.
It's really good. It's really, really good. It's long, but it's very, very good. So I think it runs through the middle of December. So if you're into that, go check it out.
My birthday's coming up.
I would also like to see, there's some things I would like to see in LA, including The Brothers Paranormal at East West Players, 222. CTG.
Yeah, I really want to see 222.
I feel like there's something else. I'll think of it. Scott, CJ.
Oh, Clyde.
Spitlets.
Go
see Clyde's.
Yeah. I want to hype December 16th and 17th at the Broadwater Complex, second stage. Thank you. Is James
the
McQueen's
place you work? Yeah, perfect.
Yes, that's where I work. James McQueen's Reflect on Women. This is part of Sacred Fool's Ladder Up program. It basically provides resources to artists from systematically underrepresented areas of the theater community, gives them a spot and some stuff to work on. But this is two nights of female choreographers. And come out and support it. You can visit sacredfools.org to get ticket information and more information on the show. But I also really want to give a huge shout out to our own CJ Merriman, who has been part of the creation of this whole project and this whole, not just specifically James McQueen's thing, but the whole Ladder Up program. So on behalf of everybody, thank you so much, CJ, for your hard work.
My pleasure. I have one spotlight. Mrs. Dilber's Fabulous Bed Curtains. It's a comedic reimagining of the Christmas Carol, and it's at the Loft. I love Christmas shows, so I'm going to go see it. It's at Loft Ensemble December 3rd through the 18th, Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 7. Tickets by donation, y'all. Loftensemble.org. Check it out.
Word.
Can't wait for that. Yeah, I think we definitely need more Christmas Carol adaptations. I'm kidding. That was me. I'm no, it sounds amazing. It sounds incredible.
Meow.
Go see it. Go see it. Well, no, I'll go see it. I'm gonna go.
Yeah,
since I just said something shitty, I'll go see it. I will pay the money.
We'll all get together.
Booze pie donation there too. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
We'll go to little Dom's across the street.
Yeah, we'll go have dinner. Let's we'll do a little night of it. Why not?
I'm just being a dick. I'm just being.
You're a dick.
Thank you, Kevin, for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Great having you here.
Yeah.
I love talking about nerd shit. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got two more weeks of it with us, luckily. Yeah. Next time we'll let you talk more, because I feel like we did the thing that we always do, which is we don't shut up for an hour and a half.
I have a lot more to say about the other plays, so you won't be able to get me to shut
up.
It'll be awesome.
It's also, I feel like we said everything you can say about this one. We blanketed it a little bit. We didn't get deep, but that's not what we do here. We don't get deep. It's a macro look. We're talking more about the evolution, so we'll talk about why, if this was his first play, what does it look like when he's writing things later in his life, but still sticking to the same source material of history,
when he's like
right?
doing when he's writing well instead of whatever was.
When he's doing it correctly. Yeah. Yes. So that'll be exciting. But thank you all for joining us for Theater. Next week is Hencast the 6th Pod 2.
Yes.
Where we'll be talking about Richard the 2nd. Mm-hmm. So brush up on your Dick 2. And we, after that, we're doing Henry V. So read that one as well, or go watch the Kenneth Branagh one. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to rewatch that. I'm not going to rewatch that for this.
I might rewatch it, because I was just thinking, I have not seen it in years and years and years. So I might rewatch it, but I might try and find somebody. I might watch Olivier's.
But then after that, we're done. We're done till probably January or February. I don't know what we're looking at, but this is the end of the season, y'all. So this is a bonus. We're just being nice, so you have something to listen to during the holidays.
Yes.
Siege?
Do y'all have questions or comments? We love it when we hear from you guys. So you can reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme songs. Theme song. And this is just a fact. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
It's true.
He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. I've known him for almost 14 years, and I did that math this week, and it freaks me out. Ryan, we love you. A big shout out to Pam Quinn. Is Pam writing a Shakespeare-centric song?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, we still love Pam. She contributes frequently to the show.
Did she do it the last two times?
I don't think she did.
I don't think so.
Did she? Well,
no,
let's go
I
back
think
and
we
listen.
Just play the bonus episode song.
Okay. Well, we'll do that then, which she wrote, and we love her. And then finally, to the great Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Annie Baker, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Annie Baker, we're going to buy you a beer.
It's true. Do us all a favor, y'all. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. Thank you, Kevin, once again.
Yes. Pleasure having you.
Come listen to us next week, and we'll see you later. Thanks, guys. Bye.
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 Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book and make me a perfect match.
Later, everybody.
It's time for a bonus. A bonus episode. I love episodes of theater. We're going off the beaten path.